Hello, friends and family, and thank you for tuning into the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. I got some very exciting news. Not only are we still sponsored by Monsanto, Monsanto is an incredible company filled with farmer-friendly scientists dedicated to futurizing our seeds and vegetables so that we no longer have to eat these old-fashioned crap vegetables that our ancestors grazed upon back in the dark ages when people didn't know that you were supposed to take showers and it was common to throw babies in the fireplace just for fun. No longer like that. We now have access to futuristic, genetically modified, genetically engineered fruits, vegetables, and food. And soon, if Monsanto has their way, then every single living organism will be genetically modified and engineered so that we all taste much better. I actually went golfing with the head of Monsanto 3 days ago. His name is Vizodok V5. You won't find his name on the internet if you look his name up. He's a silent partner, runs the whole organization. Really cool guy. He's in his mid-20s. He told me I'm welcome to talk about him on the podcast because nobody's going to believe it anyway. But this guy is amazing. He's a multi-trillionaire. He has these futuristic glasses. I've never seen anything like this before. They fuse when he puts them on his head. They fuse into the skin of his head. And apparently he wouldn't let me look it through them because he said, if you're not at the trillionaire level, the things that you'll see through these glasses can cause your heart to stop, blah, 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 make you go crazy, make you go mad. But when I asked him, well, what do you see through those things? He just smiled and he said, spiders. That's it. So who knows? Interesting glasses, interesting man. He's a great guy, and Monsanto's an incredible company, and he made this awesome joke. He said that if I keep doing these great commercials for Monsanto, then he's going to take me into the subterranean chambers beneath his mansion and finger bang me in the screaming room. He's funny, great company, so make sure you get out there and buy as much genetically engineered food as you can. Feed it to your babies, feed it to your dogs. Let's all get on the genetically modified bandwagon so that we can taste the future. Monsanto. And if you go to monsanto.edu and enter my name in, they will send you a Vertropion ear bile, which is a fungal ear bile that you can put behind your ear, and it will remove all feelings of empathy or compassion, a big burden these days to feel those kinds of old primitive appendix feelings, as I call them. It just makes you just skate on the very surface of things and not worry about any of these thought patterns that get into your head like, oh, maybe I should love more. All gone. Thank you, Monsanto. And now a quick cancer update.
Cancer. Doctors. CAT scans.
Hi guys, it's me, Duncan Trussell. Here's my cancer update. I got my test back. I have what's called a type 2A testicular cancer. That means that the thing in my balls was not a rare diamond or a ruby, as I was hoping, but was a cancerous tumor. And it also means that my lymph nodes are slightly enlarged, a little over 2 centimeters. The good news with this is it means I don't have to get chemotherapy. If it had been a later stage cancer, if my lymph nodes had been bigger, if the thing in my balls had been more severe, if there had been cancer in my blood, or if there had been stuff in my chest or my brain, I would have had to take a big hit off the chemo bong, brother. And that's no fun. So it's just 4 weeks before I will finally be able to start smoking through my penis again, which I miss doing so much. But that's the problem. If you let your penis smoke, your balls can get cancer. But the odds of my other ball getting cancer is really slim. So my cock is going to start smoking Marlboro Reds again, and I'm going to start eating my favorite dish, which is cheeseburgers, McDonald's cheeseburgers mashed with ranch fries, blue cheese ranch fries. Cannot wait for that. So check your balls, everyone. Don't be a fool. All you got to do is reach your sweet hand down into your pants and squeeze those darling balls. Give them a hug with your hand. Hug your balls with your hand, and when you do, think of me and say, thank you, Duncan, for inspiring me to check my balls. And say that 3 times when you look in the mirror, and I will appear, and I will hold your balls. That's science fact.
Say my name 3 times and I'll appear and hold your balls. No matter where you are, I'll grind through the walls. I'll squeeze those balls to make sure that one's not bigger, that one's not firmer, that one's not painful. I'll squeeze your balls because it's fun. I'll squeeze your balls because you're the one.
Go to testicularcancerawarenessfoundation.org and learn to check your balls. I love them. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Shure Design T-Shirts. Shure Design T-Shirts is an incredible company located in Thailand. And here's an interesting trivia fact about Shure Design T-Shirts. When Jesus was being crucified on the terrible cross of nails in Golgotha, and he gazed out upon the crowd watching him die, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And what he meant is they don't realize that they could be wearing a far more comfortable t-shirt. Our Savior knew that had the people of that time period been wearing softer t-shirts, they wouldn't think that crucifixion was the solution for dealing with somebody telling people to love each other more. But that didn't happen, because Shure Design t-shirts didn't exist back in that time period, and Jesus was not a time traveler. But now you can experience the softness that Jesus longed for by going to shuredesignt-shirts.com and entering my name in. You will get 10% off these magnificent, soft, beautiful t-shirts, incredible designs that look as though the people at Shure Design t-shirts plucked the third eye out of the Pope and squeezed it on top of a canvas. These are beautiful, psychedelic, Eastern style designs that will make you the hit of any yoga studio, swingers party, or LSD conference that you happen to be attending. ShureDesignT-shirts.com. Go check them out. We're also sponsored by Audible.com. Audible creates, has audio books that are read by trained actors. Now, I know a lot of you out there like these old flop books. You like to put your hands on the floppy post-tree material that books are written on, but from time to time, it's nice to be able to listen to a book. Because when we were kids, it was one of our favorite things to have our parents read to us. Who out there didn't love that feeling of your mother reading to you at night while rubbing oil into your chest? And that was a good, relaxing feeling. You can have that feeling again. Get some. Go to audibletrial.com/family hour and download one of their amazing selections of books. They have a lot of they keep up with all the bestsellers, but they also have a lot of, they've got the Brothers Karamazov, they've got Les Miserables, they've got a lot of these great books that if you read them, you end up skimming and missing everything. But if you listen to them, especially the Brothers Karamazov, even though it'll take you 45 years to finish the book, you hear how beautiful the Russian names are in that incredible book. And there's fun books there too. Go to audibletrial.com/family hour. Download a book. You will get a free download. Download the audiobook. If you sign up for a trial membership, plug in your earbuds, rub some oil into your, dress like your mom, and rub oil into your own chest, and you will enjoy this book that much more. So, and they send us $15, so it's a way for you to support the podcast. So go to audibletrial.com/family hour and sign up. And big thanks to all of you who have been buying the new t-shirts from the shop. We've got some awesome new t-shirt designs in the shop. And huge thanks to those of you who have been sending us donations or who have been using our Amazon portal, which is located at DuncanTrussell.com. Basically, if you are going to buy something from Amazon, just go to DuncanTrussell.com, click on the portal, and they send us a percentage of whatever you buy. So that's a cool way to support the podcast. But, and also there's other ways that support us, not financially, just by going to the message board and joining the forum. Stop lurking. A lot of you guys are lurking there. Throw your hat into the ring. Get in on the conversation happening there. Another way you can support us is just by going to iTunes and giving us a nice rating or leaving a nice comment. And if you don't feel like doing any of that, that's fine too. Just enjoy the podcast and listen and continue to listen. Today's guests on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour are the hosts of a new amazing podcast, the Mind Rolling Podcast. You can find that at www.mindrolling.com. They are Raghu Marcus and David Silver. Raghu Marcus is the executive director of the Love Serve Remember Foundation. That's Ram Dass's foundation. He actually got to meet Neem Karoli Baba, the enlightened being that Ram Dass often talks about in his books and Be Here Now, Grist for the Mill, and in his lectures. He also launched the Triloka record label, which is a record label that was home to Krishna Dass, who is this incredible performer who sings kirtans. And he's an amazing human. Regardless of all that worldly stuff, he's just an incredible human being. I've been fortunate enough to meet him. He's come over a few times, and every time he never fails to blow my mind. And David Silver is a hilarious human being that I was lucky enough to meet through Raghu Marcus. He's a writer, activist, producer, director. He's was a consultant on the movie Taking Woodstock with Ang Lee. He's worked with legends like Ringo Starr, Mick Jagger, Roger Waters, Allen Ginsberg, Paul McCartney. Both of these human beings are real iconoclasts, and it's really cool that I get a chance that I get to meet them in this incarnation. They're awesome people. So please send out your third eyes, embrace the pineal gland of these two humans, focus your orgasmic love energy in the direction of one day causing these two humans to fuse together into a kind of Optimus Prime synthesis. Two humans fusing together as one being. That's right, I think they should get married. Please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, Raghu Marcus and David Silver, hosts of the Mind Rolling Podcast, located at mindrolling.com. And also, sorry for the sound quality, we did this through a phone because David's in New York and Raghu is located in Asheville, NC. All right, let's do it. Good evening. Hello, friends. We're here with David and Raghu from the Mind Rolling Podcast, a podcast that focuses on spirit. Would you guys say spirituality, meditation? How would you describe your podcast?
Oh, not at all.
You guys always.
God, no. That sounds like a horrible show, actually.
No.
No, I mean, you know, we talk about our own fuck-ups from beginning to end, starting when we came up and, you know, as hippies and got into radio and all. So it's culture, consciousness, and adventures on the road around the world.
Gotcha.
Well, is that right, Dave?
And tremendous failings on our part.
Tremendous, yes.
I mean, beyond anything, this is where we excel.
It failing?
Yeah, and big flaws. Like, you know, and having to somehow climb out of various pits in order to see any kind of faint light.
That's so, more about you, though.
Well, at least I'm honest.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, Duncan, seriously, I mean, yeah, we didn't really want to pontificate about spirituality, but yeah, I mean, the answers involve a lot of spiritual practice. But for me, the word practice involves rehearsal. And it's like a violinist, a great violinist still has to practice every day. So in order to achieve any kind of mental or emotional or any kind of growth, you do have to kind of practice. So we do talk about how we've learned to do various, I've been fortunate enough to meet teachers who have helped us to get out of these various things. Because I think we're all human, and unless someone kind of shines the light sometimes, you can go your whole life in a kind of misery, you know.
Yes.
Hey, Duncan, you should talk, because what we were talking offline so to speak, about what you've been confronting and how that has become what a that's the guru right there. That teacher just rang your door, and there you were face to face. You know, that was
yeah. The guru really is hanging out in one of my balls in the form of a swollen, cancerous testicle. But that's how it happens. You know, this is something we were talking about, and this is one of the big, there are many shifts that have happened in my thinking since I got cancer. And one of them, but one of the notable things that I realized is that this stuff that, regardless of what you want to practice, spirituality, I know it's got so, the problem with it, and I can understand the hesitation of wanting to even use the term spirituality anymore, because so many sandal-clad, stinky, nefarious, backward sons of bitches use that word to describe what they're doing when all they're trying to do is get their hands in your wallet or down your pants. But, yes. You know, the word, what it points to, is this incredible mind, transcendent mind state that you can reach. That it's almost like you climb out of the swampy puddle of human existence that you are stuck in unless you run into the, it's like somebody teaching you how to take a shower mentally. I don't know, there's a lot of different ways to put it, but to summarize, since I got this, I realized how useful the tools that you learn from teachers become. You know, because when you're sitting across from the doctor and he's telling you that you have to get one of your balls chopped off, that is a direct contact. That is like French kissing the second noble truth of Buddhism, the cause of suffering is attachment, because I'm attached to my balls, man. Literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it couldn't be a bigger lesson than that. No, that's absolutely right. But, you know, at the same time, when you're sitting across from the desk of the doctor and he says this shit, your whole world stops. I mean, I've had other experiences, and I understand, you know, that moment, and it can be just somebody else. You might know somebody who you're with, and they've just gotten, you know, an intense, you know, report about what it is that they're going to be health-wise. You know, health always being, you know, of course, a major attachment, an issue.
Yes.
And your world stops, and suddenly the presence is totally there in that moment, and everything else falls away. And that's really what you experienced. I know, as you were telling me this, that's what happened in that moment. And then and we've talked about Ram Dass before. I know you've talked about him on your show, but
yes,
it's that fierce grace moment where, you know, this is devastating that you get, you know, this message. And then suddenly that presence is there and you're just in the moment and you realize the value of which, you know, how this is really moving you along on your little journey. So, yeah, I think it's a tremendous thing. I don't know why, because I have this on my mind. David sent me a text, and he's got to tell you this story. He was on a plane from Florida to New York the other day, like day before last. And please describe this, but I'd like to hear the whole thing. I was on the floor. It was a terrible thing that happened to poor Dave, but I was on the floor. I could barely breathe. Dave, tell us this thing. Talk about being confronted by some suffering.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty good flyer. You know, I'm not one of those people terrified anymore. I used to be years ago, but not anymore. This flight was scary beyond words. It was flying into a windstorm in New York. And, you know, it was a JetBlue, so there was a screen in front of you telling about the weather all over the country. And it was basically fine everywhere except Canada. It was even good in New Jersey. So I'm watching this and thinking, okay, that's not too great, but I'm cool. The pilot got on up first and was very proud to tell us that he was an Air Force One pilot. And the pilot had some president for quite a long time. So, you know, it's cool. When we get to New York, it was impossible. The runways had wind shear. Different runways had different wind shear.
Oh.
And he couldn't land, and he was circling around forever, but he was circling for a long time in horrible chop. It was just jerking down. It was one of those times when you really needed the seatbelt. Otherwise, your head would hit. And it was just awful, you know? And there was no getting away from it. I was trying to watch some game on the screen, and then I was reading some spiritual book, and then I was chanting. And at the end of the moment, I realized that as bad as it was, there was some aid coming to me from somewhere that I'd practiced enough to see that, okay, I'm going to remain somehow calm. And by the way, I'm not one of those who believes if I chant Om Shanti, the plane doesn't go down. That's not the point. The plane may well go down. It's how I go down.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in that moment, you know, in that there's a film called Fearless with Jeff Bridges. Fantastic film, which I really recommend to anybody who hasn't seen it, where he's in a plane crash. And the rest of the film is about, you know, dealing with the aftermath. Well, I didn't actually think I was going to crash, but I was full of fear. Just no question about it. And my girlfriend, who was sitting next to me, just wasn't. She was kind of like listening to her earphones and smiling when the plane dropped 1,000 feet. I was just thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be, I wrote to Raga, I'm going to be a bunch of molecular matter floating over Queens very soon. But did it help? You know, Duncan, I can't really say it made me calm. But it was definitely better than, say, 25 years ago when I would have just been, if not screaming, well, I would have been screaming. Even,
but you're not telling anybody who was listening to this would think, what the hell was he laughing about? I mean, I wasn't laughing about the fact that you were in this incredible turbulence and wind shear and were scared out of your mind and were doing some mantras. I was laughing about what happened with the baby and the mother next to you. Tell that.
There was a woman who I hope never listens to this, who I'd noticed in the airport, actually. She was sitting in a wheelchair, and I thought, I had all kinds of empathy for her because she had a small child, and I thought, oh, she's, you know, somewhat paralyzed and she has to deal with this very impish small child. And then at one point she just got out of the wheelchair and actually ran across the terminal. I realized she was just sitting in a wheelchair. Then when she got on the plane, she brought a gigantic sort of car seat, which you don't bring to put the baby in. And meanwhile, she's on headphones the whole time listening to music. Then the baby, during the horrible turbulence, pissed all over the chair and all over the plane.
The car seat.
And then the mother tried to put the car seat above without asking my girlfriend, and the piss dropped on Sandra's head. And the mother then shouted through her headphones, which she still had on, "It's okay, it's only milk." I was watching it. It was sort of amber-colored baby urine. So, you know,
how mindful and collected was your girl?
She was cool. She was cool, right? Because she'd had a couple of wines.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, she had really had a, when she hears this, she will kill me. But she had a couple of wines. I was completely straight, and I was watching this and thinking, this is maybe I'm already dead, and this is some kind of humorous afterlife after the plane blows up. But you know, that's basically the story. By the way, when we landed, I'm one of those, you know, really cheesy people that goes up to the pilot and says, "What a great job." That's what I said to him. And he looked at me and he said, "I wouldn't fucking fly a kite in this weather."
Jesus, that is so scary.
Yeah, but you know, as scared as I was, I wasn't as scared as I was maybe early in my life or something. Because, I mean, there was something going on in my head about, oh, if this is it, it's it, you know. I mean, you got to die sometime. Maybe this is a good way to go.
Well, I think what you just said, I think that is the real component here is that I don't care how many mantras you chant or how many different breath exercises you've memorized or whatever the thing is that you've come up with, that it's not going to help that initial animalistic fear, which is your body not wanting to die. It's not going to stop that. But there is this other thing that kicks in where the fear of death itself is lessened, or this idea of like, well, you know, what I kept thinking is like, oh, I guess this is like, I'm going to get to see another dimension soon, depending on, you know, how the CT scans come back. I might really be plunging into some alternate universe, you know, within a few months or however long. And that,
right.
You know, that I don't think I would have thought that if not for all of the, not just the different scriptures I've read, but the psychedelics that I've taken. And mm-hmm. something yeah. about that makes it so that your attachment to life or your attachment to you're not operating under the delusion that this is all there is or that this is going to last forever.
Exactly. I think that's really a great point. That once you get a perspective, whatever little particle of that perspective you can get, definitely. And not just that, but loss. I mean, you were losing an organ. People, you know, I almost lost my daughter some years ago. I was very sick in the hospital. you know, you lose things all the time, even if it's just your iPad charger, you know.
Yes.
And it's amazing that when I left my iPhone charger in Raghu's room a couple of weeks ago in Maui, I was kind of angry when I got home and realized I had to buy another one. I'd lost it. It was gone. It was a fucking iPod charger. You know, I mean, that's how ridiculously ingrained it is, these fear-based syndromes that go round and round and round. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Raghu, you know, that given all your time in India, much more than myself, and a tremendous amount of time with the guru and then with other great teachers, I mean, don't you think that that has assuaged some of the...
Ready.
Yeah, that's it's an interesting question, Dave, actually. It's actually something I've been thinking about lately as I have a big deal with anger. Okay, that's my toughest point of being able to have enough space around it. I don't get lost in it. And I've noticed lately that there is more space around, way more space. And I attribute, it's just a matter of time. The more time that's gone by, from the point at which I understood that through psychedelics, all that, you know, a long time ago, that this was not all there was. The senses were not all there was. There is another dimension. And from that point forward, then through, once I met Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, then I knew that all was totally possible, no matter of psychedelics or anything like that, but there, smack in front of me, was somebody who was actually living everything I had ever read about or even dreamed was possible in a human. And so that created another wedge so that I wasn't getting lost as much. And that getting lost as much reduced over the span of time to where there's just way more spaciousness around it.
Can I ask you ask you before about Neem Karoli Baba? When you say that, what do you mean? Like, can you describe him? What was that like to be around him? Or what was he doing that made you think he was so incredible? Was it, what were the symptoms of this, of his enlightenment or whatever this being was?
Okay. Well, one of the very first immediate gut level thing was, this wasn't new. It was like he wasn't somebody brand new that, you know, you meet somebody that you've never met it before. I knew this person, this being. And the second thing was, shit, there's nobody there. There is no, you're talking back and forth, and there, you absolutely know in your bones that this being does not want anything whatsoever. There's no, it's not the kind of usual give and take that you have with a normal human, where you're kind of, when you meet somebody, you're kind of fencing around, who are they, you know, who am I, what complexity level of what they want or I want from them, or even if it's just neutral, do I care enough about, you know, all of the stuff that goes on when two people meet. None of that was going on. Zero. I could have just, it was sort of like, you know, a computer that knew the right thing to do that was perfect for whatever I needed to hear. I mean, that was the second thing. But the first thing was, there's absolutely no one that I was relating with in any way that I have ever experienced before in my life, period. And then mixed in with that was just, shit, I'm not thinking about, I realized that I wasn't thinking about past or future. You know, after a while, I'd be, you know, or I'd get up from sitting with him, and I just, like, been somewhere, but I wasn't thinking, you know, about past or future. And I, you know, it was total just being in with that, all that bullshit that people talk about. And, of course, what, you know, this is Ram Dass's thing, for those of you that, I think Duncan talks about Ram Dass, so you know who
I
he
do.
Is. Be here now. I mean, you know, it's all just words that don't mean anything until you actually get in that moment and you experience it. So yeah, those were the key thing. You can't say the words that mean anything because they can't really deliver on it. You know, an ocean of love, okay, is that that's the small, you know, that's like horrible, cliched, poetic illusion, you know.
Well, that's a problem, isn't it? That's a damn problem, because what happens is people do encounter and experience people like him, and they also encounter and experience moments of like profound moments, but because so many people have already encountered these moments in the past and have used the best words they could think of to describe it, the words themselves have become watered down. So
sometimes, Duncan, not always. As I say, when I was on this plane to get out of that for a minute, I had been reading this Castaneda book that I hadn't read for 20 years. I just picked it up as I left for the airport. And he was talking about the active part of infinity and a lot of stuff about stopping the world. And as a Yaqui shaman, talking about the way the life beyond the life can be brought to you in a second. So I'm reading this amazing stuff by a shaman. And when the rock and rolling started happening on the plane and I was feeling kind of scared, it did affect me. The fact that Castaneda is such a good writer. I mean, really. He writes from the heart. He talks about his own fucked up life and how he could never get close to the real truth of what the shamans were talking about. But I was reading it just before all this happened, and it did go through my bloodstream somewhat. It just did. And what the point I'd like to make about that is that for people who are listening who never feel like they've met a guru or whatever, there is secondhand transmission. There definitely is. You don't have to sit next to the guru. What you have to do is trust the person who's talking to you. So if it's a writer and the writing is sufficiently authentic, you begin to trust the writer. If it's a friend, you trust your friend. Like when I met Raghu and Krishnadas and Ramdas and many others who'd been in India with Nkoreli back in the 70s, I hadn't been there. But I knew these people were very hard-nosed people, funny people, kind of sophisticated people, you know, great friends, fun to be around, whatever. And they weren't bullshitters and they weren't liars. And they weren't even hippies, really. So it was easy for me to assimilate, to sort of absorb the guru through them because I knew they weren't lying. And that's like a good writer, you know. So I think there is always a way. The big key to this is practice. I'm obsessed with that word right now. That is in the sense of rehearsal. You just keep reading, keep trying, keep meditating, stay close to the people that are articulating four dimensions rather than three.
Huh. Hey, Duncan.
Yes.
Do you know? Sorry to interrupt you, Dave. But
all right,
I'm because you're talking about writers, and I am thinking of somebody who I do know of someone, like when I read it, that they are able to express in words that aren't cliched incredibly what that thing is, you know, that full-on siddha presence, you know, the real thing. And we can talk about that too. But his name is Hafiz. You know Hafiz, H-A-F-I-Z?
Yeah, I've heard of him. I don't think I've read anything.
Okay, so he has poems that are descriptions of what we're talking about. Of like what when you say what is that being that come way closer than anything I ever read in a poetic way. So
you're so right, Raghu. I agree with you. Rumi's like that too. The whole tradition of ancient Persian. And
isn't it weird that the Muslims have the greatest poetry around what that thing is, and they've, you know, and then they have the other side of the coin, which is, you know, pretty...
Well, that's perverted. That's the other thing, which is Wahhabi extremism. It has very little to do with what Hafiz was talking about. I mean, you're right, Raghu. Duncan?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you still? Okay. I was just saying that reading Hafiz is really easy because they're like nine-line poems, most of them. They're like songs. And you read them, and it's like a hit in the head. It's like getting hit in the head because he hits it every time. He may just be talking about, you know, the outhouse of his house, or a flower in the garden, or a girlfriend who rejected him. It's very down to earth.
Right.
But somehow the words...
It
get you.
Hafiz is a shit. Absolutely.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I love him.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you something, actually, which was to get back a little bit to when you were shocked by this, you know, news that you had to have surgery and all that. How long did it take you to just sort of acclimate to that and go, okay, that's that, I'm not going to let it destroy my life?
Well, it was... You get the initial doc. You get the. They tell you this thing, and then your brain is. I consider this thing kind of like a. In my mind, I think of these things as like a phase shift where you're in between two different subjective realities, and as you're sort of, you know, as your mind, you know, obviously you're just in one reality, but your mind lets you exist in realities that are different from where you really are. That's what delusion is. So when truth comes, it causes this amazing fast spin towards where you're really supposed to be. It's the mental equivalent of falling down. So when you're falling down, there's that state of completely being out of control. You have vertigo. And then, so the moment that you really hit the sooner you accept the truth is the sooner that imbalance and a lot of the terror associated with that kind of imbalance goes away. You just have to let yourself hit the ground and accept it. And so it took me, you know, I think it was after I got my CT scans and got home, when I finally drove home, that's when I started acclimating to this idea and started calming down a little bit. And it sounds so morbid, and I really don't want to die or exit this dimension. I really like it here a lot. I'm having a lot of fun. But yeah. Something in me thought, well, you know, that death, I thought of what Ram Dass said, dying is safe. And that's what I started thinking is like, man, yeah, this is just you know, just being in the hospital and going through the path, you know, through the different weird paths that they have already set up for you with the electrocardiogram and the CT scans and being around all the people in various stages of degeneration or the healers who are there to help them, suddenly you realize like this is well-trod terrain. And you know what I mean? This isn't, if you're dying, you are not about to, you're not experiencing some new thing. You're experiencing the oldest thing there is. So you know, except for life. So something about that made me start calming down. And you know, I'm not gonna act like I wasn't, you know, just like when you're in that plane, you can't escape from the kind of like sucking horror that comes into you when you really consider the fact like, yeah, my physical body might cease functioning because of this disease. You can't stop that crazy feeling, but you can control how you react to that feeling.
Yes, and that's the key right there for sure, bullseye. You can, and well, you know, you just have to wrap that word control around something else that's less control, which is just aligning yourself with more of just, you know, universal flow, whatever you want to call it. You know, you can call it anything, but you do want to align yourself there. So, you know, it's not, it's, you know, that's the other thing in my experience in India and being with Maharaji and all. And he used to even say it. I mean, there's a two-way street between you and the universe. I mean, you do the best that you, like, you're doing everything you can to heal yourself. At the same time, you're confronting the idea of death and what that is, and that's helping you to grow. And, you know, every one of us has had, you know, somewhat similar experience. We do have, we will have them, you know, at some point in our lives, sooner than later is probably better, just so you're more prepared. But there is, you know, you put that effort out, the universe speaks back to you.
Yes.
And you know, so that there's a real you know, there's a real collaboration with the spirit, with that, whatever way that divinity shows itself to you, there's a collaboration with it.
That's right.
And I guess you have to say that the old, you know, Christian thing about asking, it will be answered, the door will be opened. You actually have to ask. It's weird, but, you know, you
but
do
it's even
have to
preordained that you ask. That's the other thing.
Exactly.
I mean, your karma is that you ask.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that karma, you know, like you can't even go there. So ultimately, that's why this whole thing with Ram Dass, the fierce grace concept, is really, you know, and how that really works. And it's very difficult to describe, but you're right in the middle of it.
Well, I'm in the middle of it, and much of what I've learned from Ram Dass just really came in handy here, especially that, you know, the documentary Fierce Grace, when you see him, you know, in this new, you know, physical state where he's, you know, lost the control he had over his body. And also, you know, just the amazing ways that he's reacting to it. Like this just, you know, how like when your body slows down, it gives you more time to meditate, you know, stuff like that. He's taking basically, and this is in his book, Grist for the Mill, too. He talks about how some of his students, I guess, were getting annoyed because there was a siren outside. And this was interrupting their meditation. But he was saying, this is just a form of energy that you can convert into whatever you want it to be. You're automatically converting the phenomena of the subjective of your world. You're automatically converting it into something. And that's your apprehension of whatever it is that's happening. But people just think that the initial apprehension is just the way it really is, instead of understanding that that is a conditioned apprehension that you learn from your parents or from whoever was influential in your life, and that you have control over that apprehension. So suddenly these events, whether it's a stroke, your balls get cut off, or all the other variety of bizarre things that can happen to you in this dimension, suddenly each of those events transform from something that you have no control over. It's sort of like packets of energy that you can convert into whatever you want to convert it into. You can turn that energy into the Dante's Inferno. You can decide that you're living in a hell dimension and live in constant anger and suffering or bitterness. Or you can turn that into something where like, oh, okay, this is like I'm getting a chance to wrestle with the universe here. So let's do it. I'll do it. I can do this. This is a chance for me to this is a high dive, and I get to be a diver who can do any kind of flip that I want off of this thing, or I can belly flop. You know, and that's something I think, you know, Ram Dass is really good at articulating. And
he always was. I mean, you know, that's the thing. At different times in his life, he's articulated it from that exact place in his life he's at. So when he was a younger man and I was first listening to his lectures, he was talking about, you know, human foibles all the time and how we kid ourselves and how we're living in fear and how we have masks on and all of that. And it was always very funny, and you always recognized it in yourself. Now, after the stroke and with the, you know, the vision that he has now, you know, he's teaching us all how to, you know, just detach a little from this and understand that, you know, it goes on. And if you've never given it a moment in your life, try and catch in and try and catch that somehow, it might be difficult for you when something really difficult does happen. I'm not talking about death. I'm just talking about loss. I mean, the Buddhists, you know, most of them, you know, talk about impermanence all the time, you know, and Native Americans have talked about, you know, this is a good day to die.
Yeah.
What is that all about, you know? Well, it's really about finding that space, I suppose. It's not even a space. Space doesn't work. It's an attitude. You know,
could I tell you about my impermanent experience?
Yes,
Duncan.
Please.
I was way back when I was in India. I've talked to you about this particular meditation method called Vipassana, insight.
Yes.
So after you do this, you know, this is the ultimate, that you gain insight into the impermanence of nature, right? So it's a 10-day course. You're meditating, I don't know, 12 hours. It's some crazy thing, you know, and we're there. You know, after about 8 days, you're way in there, boy. I mean, you are so precisely in the moment after that much meditating. But a lot of stuff still is coming up and being released, you know. So the Pali word, I believe it's Pali and not Sanskrit, but maybe, is called for impermanence. It's called anitya. So, and the teacher was this incredible barrel-chested man with his deep voice, you know, and he would break up the meditation, you know, just like you might having, you know, whatever experience, and it was all going to be impermanent. Well, one day, this young woman, we're deep into the meditation, like, you know, it's an hour, each session is an hour, and it's like three quarters of the way through. And suddenly, this woman starts to have an orgasm. She is, like, getting laid in the middle of this room in this, you know, I mean, there are, like, 80 to 100 people in this room. and you can hear a pin drop, and suddenly you hear her, you know, in the intense cries of orgasm.
Wow.
The whole room went with this woman. I knew it. In an instant, I wasn't that far away from her. I was lost within a millisecond. I was gone into,
Wait.
The whole room, this woman is having, literally, she's having an orgasm. Whatever happened, something opened up in the middle, because, you know, the depth of this meditation. Then suddenly, in the middle of this, you hear this huge booming voice. Anitya. This woman stopped dead in her tracks. That was it. Gone. Impermanent. Finished.
Wow. Cool.
That was the greatest impermanence teaching I was ever involved with.
That's super cool.
Should only happen to you.
I love that. That reminds me of this a story I heard about Prabhupada. The Hare Krishna guy.
Yeah.
And there was a woman chanting or said to him, you know, when I chant Hare Krishna, I see this glowing light that comes floating towards me. And he said, keep chanting, it'll go away.
That's actually pretty high.
Yeah.
That's really, that's great. I was thinking you were going to say something else, not so illuminating, but
well, look, you know, everybody's got a different, you know, it seems like there's a lot of different people out there trying to express this idea that we're talking about, and you know, it seems like different people express, it's almost like, you know, they say that the gospels were written for different types of people, or they say there's different types of yoga for different types of people, and it seems there's different ways that this message articulates itself, and for some people it's amazing, and for other people you hear it and you're like, give me a fucking break, that's idiotic, until you realize like, oh, that's just not the frequency I'm meant to hear. It's still the thing, it's just tuned into a different part of the thing that I don't respond to at all, you know.
I wish the people around me where I live here, and I hope they're not listening, in the deep woods of North Carolina, and because all the churches are Jesus is the only way, and I'm like, it may not be the only way. Can we have a dialogue? But that's not happening. So that is an issue all the way to all of these different yoga methods and all of that, where people, you know, it's just people attached to their way being the only way, and it manifests itself in its most gross form here in America with fundamentalism, but not here in America. I mean, fundamentalism in India, there's terrible fundamentalism, and you know, of course, in the Middle East as well. So yeah, that's a huge issue, isn't it?
Well, it's wherever there's, you know, wherever there's lazy people, there's going to be fundamentalism, because it's that difference between esoteric versus exoteric, where there's people who are just going to attach themselves to the symbols, you know, not realizing that the symbols are specifically there to, you know, whatever the scriptures you're into, when it came out, those symbols were not dated. That was like the height of technology. So when you're using these different symbols and whatever the religion is, it makes a lot, you know, for example, in the chapter one of the Bhagavad Gita, when there's that description of the battlefield that they're fighting on, and there's all these different, you know, Indian heroes that they're talking about, Bhishma, Drona, you know, all the different like fighters on that field. You know, when we hear that, it means nothing to us, unless you've really studied the Mahabharata, or unless you were raised in India. If you're in the West and you read that, you're like, well, they sound awesome. They're blowing conch shells and banging shit. That sounds exciting. But when that text came out, those names meant something to the people hearing it, because it was just trying to articulate the heroes of the world. The equivalent today would be, you know, you could fill those names in, if you like comic books, with X-Men, you know, or you could fill those symbols in with characters from Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings or Walking Dead or whatever it is to get across the point, which is this was the greatest battle in human history. That's the idea. And so fundamentalism, you know, people get caught up in the damn symbols, and then they start arguing over the symbols, and then the whole point of the thing gets lost.
You know, by the way, there's a great article relating something from the Bhagavad Gita around what happened, to that horror in Connecticut. And I need to get this to you, and I'm going to find it. This would be a great thing to pass on. It's very much taking what the essence of that is related to that war and related to the tragedy that happened, because in that war, families were getting killed. You know, your own family was getting killed in
right.
that war. And unfortunately, I can't find it right away, but I am going to find it, because it is something that's going up. We're going to put it up on ramdas.org.
I'll put a link to it on my site once you
should.
Get it.
Yeah, but I think people would really appreciate this. And I know that you're into it, too, the Bhagavad Gita. So
I love it. Well, but is it what the reason that, the reason that these symbols are being used is because the author of that text was trying to articulate the worst possible situation. The idea was, I'm going to create the worst possible situation for a person to be in, so that we get this moment that we've been talking about, the moment where you're on the plane, the moment where your balls get cut off, the moment where you get the phone call in the middle of the night because your daughter is dead, or the moment that whatever the thing is that inevitably happens in this dimension, there's all catastrophe will happen to you. And so the idea is, like, here is a catastrophic situation. Here's the setting. Now we're going to use this catastrophic situation to demonstrate different mental states that you can get in, or different states of realization you can get in, so that you can transform this catastrophe in an opportunity
exactly.
to become a hero. And that's why I love that text. But it's very, I'm positive. I know for sure, because I used to hang out with the Hare Krishnas. They would get really caught up in the symbols themselves, They would argue over the symbols and get into the very most minute detail about these symbols, when that's not from my point of view, that's not the point.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's interesting because, like, when I did go to, you say, what was it like to be with Neem Karoli Baba? Well, when I went there, I am Jewish, and I actually grew up in a fairly conservative Jewish household, which meant, we didn't go to Reform, And I went to Hebrew school half my time, was learning subjects in Hebrew, like geography. It was a horror, the whole thing, but I was brought up that way. And I go to India, and I was like, great, now, Krishna and the Gita and Ram, I'm going to be in good shape now, because I can't relate to my own religion one iota. And I get there, and the first thing he says is, where's your cross? That's the first thing he said to me. I said, cross? Like, I'm thinking, like, I'm Jewish. And then this other story, which has been told before, but just briefly, I asked him how to meditate, because I just wanted a mantra. I wanted a Hindu something, because I came to India. And he said, meditate like Christ. When he was, nailed to the cross, he felt love, not pain. And
wow.
So we're like, there was some other friends of mine were there, including Ram Dass, who's Jewish as well. And he started day to day talking about Christ, not about Hinduism. So, that just gives, that's an idea of someone who is not living in any particular duality at all. No duality. There's only coming from that place which there is only one thing going on. You can call it God. You can call it, Buddhist, pure mind, whatever it is you want to call it. There is only one thing possibly going on. And as you say, there are different ways that expresses itself, so different people can connect, because everybody can't connect, with using your mind to get there, or using a mantra, or using bhakti yoga, devotion and love, or whatever, or Zen.
And it would be, to be honest, it would be a really boring situation if that's sort of the case. No one would be able to get anything. It'd be like living in a, you know, fascist regime. So, well, everybody, you know, it's just a fact that on the planet, different collective karmas, you know, respect different symbols, if you like.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you know, the Muslims, you can say what you want about it. When I stayed with Islamic families in Morocco, they were the most hospitable and warm people I've ever met. And they had no, there was no anger, there were no guns, there was none of that at all. It was all about mystical relationship with Allah. And they would try and pass that on to us only in the way they dealt with us. You know, how warm and sweet they were.
Right.
But they were also telepathic. They were also healers. And they didn't brag about it or anything. These were just some of the most beautiful, amazing people I've ever met. But they were Muslims. And, you know, I was brought up in an atheist family. My family was basically socialist, pragmatist intellectuals. They had no interest in any religion at all. And so my father later in life, much later, like, got into Gurdjieff. But I hadn't, you know, I'm so happy that nobody ever told me to go to church or synagogue or mosque or anything. I just thought the whole thing was rubbish, actually. And so, you know, it took a long time before I could be, as it were, spiritual, if that's the word we can ever use again. But at least I was open to it because I was never brought up in that thing of, you know, you have to believe in this. This Christmas, just a few days ago, I went to High Mass in Florida, Catholic Mass. With my mother-in-law and girlfriend. And, you know, there they were, you know, doing the whole Mass thing and singing the carols and eating the wafers and everything. And, you know, yeah, there was a little frisson in me about, well, what the heck is this? This is ridiculous. There's this guy hanging from a cross, this gigantic cross at the top of the church. I don't want to look at it. It's depressing. But at the end of the day, the priest, the pastor, was talking about love, the simple things in life, and be helpful to others rather than think about powerful temples, cathedrals. That means nothing. This is what the pastor said. He was saying that it's all in the little details of life and how you react to other people and to your own problems and suffering. It's got nothing to do with how high the cathedral is. So I'm sitting there, you know, with all these straight people, mainly old people in pink pants and yellow jackets, you can imagine, in West Palm Beach. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? But then I realized the words of the guy were no different from what Ram Dass says, ultimately.
Right.
It's just that Ram Dass's way of articulating, as you said before, Duncan, very smartly, I thought, you know, we're all attuned to different kind of wavelengths, and some appeal to us and so on. We don't know why. It's a mystery. It is a mystery why someone is a devout Christian. Now, Raghu's made a really good point before. He said, okay, you can be anything, but you can't then say the Mahabharata is the only way. Get rid of the New Testament. You're deluding yourself. And conversely, they can't say, you know, a lot of fundamentalists think that yoga is black magic.
Yep.
Well, I immediately say to them, well, then, you know, forget you. Because you're just not being open. I mean, that's ridiculous to think there's someone thinks a different way that they're wrong. I mean, that's what I think we were all a bit turned off about when we were kids, you know.
Hey, but, you know, I'm really shocked, Dave, though. You went to church. You're Jewish. You can't be having wafers in Catholic church.
Well, I actually, to be honest with you, I did not go and do the wafer thing because I'd never been baptized or taken communion. So I just sat there like a Jew.
Hold on. You're not allowed to eat the wafers unless you've done the magical act.
No, Duncan. I don't think any of that's true. It's just what was coming through my head. But
don't you have to take? I do remember. You know what? Here, this reminds me of my first experience with the notion of, you know, symbols being just that, just direction pointers. When I was a kid, we were Episcopalian, and somehow I made friends with the, I guess there's priests there, but I made friends with the priest's kid. And so I would get to hang out in the church when no one was there, and we would get to go back in the room where they'd mix up the communion wafers. And I remember this kid reaching into a drawer and pulling out, like, the communion wafers. These things that, like, if you go to an Episcopal church, you get one every Sunday. So they're magical. And he pulls them out, and they're, like, in a cracker case. And he just starts eating them in front of me. And he's like, here, have some. And I'm like, what are you doing? You can't just eat those. And he's like, oh, they're just crackers. And it's really a cool moment. Like, oh, okay, these are symbols, you know, and they're not imbued with any kind of magical anything. But I do know that you have to go through certain, in certain sects of Catholicism, I think you do have to take classes before you can take communion. Because
Martin Sheen gave me a wafer once. Okay? In Catholic Church in Malibu. I went there one day. It's funny. I had just gotten back from India, and I had been with this woman saint who lives up in the foothills of Himalayas where I was, Himalayas. And I was just absolutely felt so richly fulfilled by the goddess, the female part of our universe, you know, that holds our whole, that is our whole fabric. I was totally in it, and my girlfriend at the time took me to this Catholic church in Malibu, and the preacher got up, and it was devoted to Mary, the church. That particular, it was all about the mother, and I was completely, utterly, like, in the total presence. I thought, my God, I'm like, I'm still in India. I was totally gone. Turned out, I went up and I got the wafer. That's why when you said that you went and got the wafer, I couldn't believe you did it.
No, I actually did.
I have felt guilty about that from that moment until today. So, hey, Duncan, I just have to ask you something.
Sure.
This is way off the beaten track of what we've been talking about, but I have to get this information before I know we have to leave. I don't know how long your podcasts are, but
we got a few more. The podcasts, I moved them up. They're 5 hours in length now, so we've got plenty of time.
5 hour podcast?
I'm just kidding. No, I'm kidding. No. It's like another, they're usually about an hour. So, no, go ahead. What's your.
Oh, well, okay. So we got a few minutes.
Yes.
You see, folks, I don't know if Duncan mentioned. Did you mention the thing about the lost tapes that we did?
Oh, yes. I mean,
terrible thing. Terrible.
Tragic loss.
Yeah. And you and it ended up, which I didn't know, you lost them in a bar, which really, you know, I thought at least. And that's, you know, that was really bad information. If I remember correctly.
Wait, let me explain to everyone. What happened is we recorded, there was a previous version of this podcast that I recorded, and I it was, in my opinion, one of the top three, if not the best podcast I ever did on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. And I recorded half of the podcast into a digital recorder that I left in a bar in Dallas. I'm pretty sure it was in a bar. I called all the hotels, but I felt such guilt when I realized that I lost that thing, which is why I didn't tell you it was a bar. I just told you I think I left it at a hotel.
Yes. Yes, you did. I had flown in from Madrid specifically for that, you know.
No!
I was in a hurricane. What are you talking about? I was in a hurricane with right. Trees falling on my head and howling wind.
You were risking your life, and I lost
yes.
it.
Yes.
All right, well.
And he gave it to some woman in a bar, honky-tonk woman. I, you know...
That's it. Now, wait a minute. So we talked, we were talking about last time, and I want to know where it's at. We were talking about matters of the heart, okay?
Yes.
I think that was our lovely title.
Yeah.
So you had fallen completely zonkers for this woman.
Yes.
And we were talking about that, and of course, a lot of water has gone way under that bridge,
yes.
so to speak. What happened? What's going on?
Well, we're dating now, and this.
Oh, you're still.
We hadn't even. Nothing had really happened then, but not. Yeah, she's like. She's amazing. This is a person who's like, you know, through that. But we had just, you know, it was a fairly brand new thing when I had to call her up and tell her. Well,
that's what I'm thinking. This girl's never going to talk to you again.
I had to tell her, like, would you still? If just saying I had cancer. Would you still like me? Because you never know. You know, the people react
people
to this shit like
stuff.
Yeah. No, she was through this whole thing. She's just been incredible.
Wow.
Like when she actually at one point I had my surgery got a little infected and I had to go to the emergency room to make sure it wasn't something terrible, and she drove me there, and like the whole time in the emergency room was making like the hilarious jokes and just being really comforting and funny in a real way, not a bullshit way. Because, you know, you run into people and you have this thing and they'll comfort you or in a bullshit way because you can hear underneath it they're terrified that they're going to die. And every second that they're on the phone with you, it reminds them that they're going to die and they hate that.
Right.
Exactly. So they just are like so solemn and grim. No. So, yeah, she ended up.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay. Well, that is really, you know, I love substance. People that, you know, really be there, that's big. So,
yeah,
it was,
yeah, she's incredible. I feel very lucky. I haven't really talked about her on the podcast at all, you guys.
Oh,
so.
God. Yeah, I don't even...
You just broke some news. I've kind of slightly mentioned it a little bit, but... Yeah, but no, she's amazing. Amazing human being.
Well, you know, I think the great thing about what you're doing is the way that you share who you are with however many people out there. Could be one person that you're talking to or 50,000, whatever it is. And that kind of sharing is really all about whatever I have personally gotten, and I know David as well, from all these years ago when we first, you know, took our first acid trip. You know, to this moment, you know, that's all we've done. David and I have done nothing but that all these years. We've done so many different things together, and David by himself has done incredible things at sharing. I mean, so just appreciate you. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, thank you.
Well, particularly, Duncan, as you know, I was reading a Buddhist tract last night, and there were rules. You know, there's always 9 rules, 4 ways. Or,
yeah.
The last one by this Rinpoche was, please retain your sense of humor, you know. And there's something about humor that cuts through the pontificating and the lack of belief in people. That if they're just, you know, it's so the fact that you're really funny and always and can be a serious in one moment and funny in the next, you just suppose, is not just a sort of a trick. It's a real way of getting people to listen. And maybe, you know, that's a kind of a healing. It definitely is. Not just because you're laughing. I know people say if you laugh, you feel better. That's true. But just supposing, you know, like being funny and being hilarious and honest, as Roger just said about your own life, with, you know, deeper stuff sometimes, helps people get into the deeper stuff.
Yeah.
It did with me and Ram Dass. It definitely did. Ram Dass made me listen because he made me laugh also about the human predicament.
The whole thing, you know what it is? It's a circuit. The whole thing's a circuit, as far as I can tell. It's a circuit, and it's a circuit where, you know, you get these... you get someone like Neem Karoli Baba, who no doubt came into contact with other people who something triggered whatever the chain reaction was that made him into this being that I've heard so much about. And sometimes I honestly think I can feel and slightly understand in a really, not to sound really crazy or weird, but like, so like sometimes when I hear people describe him, I think, oh yeah, that's what I've felt. But it's a very strange thing. And I know that sounds insane, but regardless, I think it's a circuit, and I think it's a, we're all playing a game of, I don't know, ping pong with information where I come in contact with you guys and have these wonderful chats and offline have these, I've had incredible talks with Raghu. You'll just call me up sometimes and we'll talk. And you always call at just the right time. It's very strange. So there's a circuit happening. That's all I'm saying. It's a feedback loop because the people who listen to that, they, you know, especially after I got this diagnosis, this wave of people reaching out to me,
it
was insane and beautiful and incredible. And then you realize like, oh, this is we're playing a game here with energy. You know, we're trying to like, I don't know what we're trying to do, but we've all in our own ways have come in contact with something that seems to be a million times greater than what words can articulate. And what else would we be compelled to do but try to articulate that just for the fun of it? It's just fun to try to put it into work for no other reason than it's just you want to describe it as best you can. It's a compulsion. You know, I don't know. I don't. Thank you for saying that. I just feel like it's just we're all part of the same thing, which is, I guess, part of a thing waking up is that it wants to describe its experience of waking up, right?
Well, it's it's compassion. That's what the Dalai Lama teaches every day. It's the very fact that you want someone else, you know, that person next to you, you want them to feel good. You want them to get a little bit freer. You want them to get a little bit less stressed. So you share whatever it is you've got. That's, you know, it comes out of basic human compassion. You know, that's where, you know, the bumper sticker of the Dalai Lama is, kindness is my only religion. And
right.
That's what it, you know. That's,
oh, that's so great. God, is that great.
Yeah, so that, yeah, that, so, but yeah, but the sharing is wonderful. It really is.
Well, it's fun. It's fun to write. Also, there's a mischievous side to it too, isn't there? It's like fun when you realize like there is the possibility that there's a large number of people on the planet who are completely asleep or completely like who've got their, they who have fixated on the matter more than anything else. And there is this other thing where it's like, holy shit, this stuff is like, there's so many awesome monkey wrenches that you could start throwing into that just for fun. And not in a way, not in an aggressive way or anything. It's just one of my favorite things. Whenever I get knocked off track, whether it's because one of my balls has gone rogue or because I've stumbled upon some really good acid or because I happened upon like a, you know, someone who has come in contact with an enlightened being in India, that one of my favorite things is getting knocked off track by the info. God, Jesus, that makes me feel so good. It's so fun to find yourself in that state of, see, it's like watching the set that you've been acting in whatever drama that you've been in, suddenly like people start coming and disassembling the set around you. And you're like, oh, fuck, I'm not even in the play I thought I was in. That's a fun feeling. I just love that. That's a fun feeling. And if there's a way to like blast that out into the world, well, that I want to do that just because it's fun to do. It's a form of entertainment. I don't know. I guess I'm trying to dodge the compassion. I have no compassion. I'm a cold-hearted being. Just kidding. I love you guys.
Well, it's been great. Yeah. It's been great. And, you know, folks out there, we haven't talked to Duncan since he's actually gone through, you know, this whole medical thing. So this is all, like, brand new to us. Literally, today, we got on the phone. We talked very briefly to set this up, and bang, then we were into it. So we're, like, you know, we're happy to know that everything's going to be great with our buddy, and also how he took this whole thing is a great, great lesson.
Well, you know what? It's 100% related to my association with you guys and to Ram Dass and to all this stuff. Sorry, I don't mean to sound preachy for those listening. Just this stuff really does work, and you are, no doubt, every single person listening to this, you will get invited to the dance floor with the Grim Reaper, so you might as well start preparing your dance moves now so that when it happens, it can be interesting instead of something terrifying. But you guys have an amazing podcast, the Mind Rolling Podcast. Where is this located?
MindRollingPodcast.com. Yeah, just go to that site, and there we are. It's on iTunes.
And why the name Mind Rolling? Why do you guys call it Mind Rolling?
Well, I'm into this particular Tibetan teacher. Her name is Khandro Rinpoche. And I saw an honorific for her that this is, Jetson Mind Rolling Khandro Rinpoche. That was her whole title. And I go, wow, mind rolling. Actually, it's not mind rolling. It's min rolling. And it represents a garden of a monastery and a tradition in Tibet. So I thought, wow, this is really great. And I said, Dave, what do you think of it? I said, to me, it means like you don't get stuck in any one dogma in your head, any one thought, that you are always moving, you know, changing. So you can always merge with that next thing, idea, truth, whatever, and you're not stuck in something. And then, Dave, you came up with?
Well, you know, mug the mind. Just mug the mind. When a mind starts dictating your whole trip, you know, just grab it by the throat and throw it away. And it's kind of that kind of coming unstuck. Mind rolling, you know, it's like rolling with the flow rather than going.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
just just on Facebook yesterday, I posted something about Marlene Dietrich, the German actress and singer from the 40s, because she was a German who went against Hitler. And I put it on there because she was a courageous woman. She did USO shows, you know, right at the front, right where Germany and France, she could have been shot on by the Nazis. The reason I put it in there was because I really admire her courage. She's an amazing woman. It's got nothing to do with Buddhism or anything like that. So we just go where it is, you know? I mean, that sounds a little, but a little smug. But you know, go where it is. You know, if it's Pink Floyd is Pink Floyd. If it's Buddhism is Buddhism. That's not to say everything's the same. But if a door opens, go through it for God's sake.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? You know, we didn't know. Just to do the final thing on what this mind rolling thing means. We thought of these things, but we had no idea what it really meant.
Right.
So and we both looked and looked and looked, finally, you know, on the net, and we Googled it up. We couldn't find anything. And finally, though, I did find a reference, and it's the mind-rolling garden, or mind-rolling garden, as they call it, is the garden of ripening and liberation. So I thought, well, here's two guys who could really aspire for some ripening and liberation along with all of our other friends. So it fit. And it's stuck, and, you know, we just hope not to get confused with the real llamas, that's all. And we hope they don't come after us is another thing. So
llamas do not
mindrollingpodcast.com. If you go to Mind Rolling, you go to these great llamas, and Khandro Rinpoche, by the way, Khandro, absolutely amazing. And if you end up there, you're probably in a better place. But otherwise, if you want to have a laugh at us, it's mindrollingpodcast.com.
Guys, go listen to that. I was the guest on one of the episodes. Go check it out. Thank you so much, Raghu and David. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate you spending some time on the Family Hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Duncan. Great pleasure, man.
Okay, I'll talk to you all soon. See you later. Go listen to the Mind Rolling Podcast. Hare Krishna. Talk to you guys later.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Here is an amazing track from Fleetwood Mac's album Rumors, available on iTunes. It's called Never Going Back Again. It's an incredible song. Go buy it on iTunes. Thanks for listening, you guys. Say hello on the forum. Rate us on iTunes. Bye.
She broke down and let me in.